I was just going to say, in regards to that variation, that one of the patients that I had written up for today is 59 years old with no true cardiac risk factors and had HER2 positive disease, node negative, and her baseline ejection fraction came back, surprisingly to me, at 48%. So I had to change my whole plan, but I still wanted to try to use Herceptin. And so I treated her with a non-anthracycline-based regimen, and I just repeated her MUGA, which I didn't have when I sent it to you, and it's 58%. And I assure you, she hasn't been training. So, you know, how many MUGAs do we do? I didn't used to do MUGAs in people who were asymptomatic just to find out if they went down a few points with Adria. And now I feel compelled, because of the black box warning and also because we don't know enough, to monitor it in some way. But I feel like I almost deprived this woman altogether of Herceptin. Now I feel a little more comfortable that I can use it, but I certainly changed my plans based on her original MUGA.
The 48% was after Adriamycin?
It was before.
It was before.
And I didn't give her Adriamycin as a result of it. This was her baseline I did before I started Adriamycin.
Right. Would you have repeated it, Dr. Steingart?
With the 48?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I would have certainly looked at it and reprocessed it.
Our nurses tell patients to have a cup of coffee and come back. Does that really make a difference on their MUGA scan?
That works for white counts, I think.
That number in a woman should be outside the normal range in most laboratories, and so I would query why.
Okay.
And absolutely getting another one would be a reasonable step. And
what do you use as a normal range for MUGA?
For a MUGA, 50.
Is there any interest, Hal, in the clinical research community in trying to more formally try to come up with some guidelines or stopping rules?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I'm not aware of groups that have specifically sat down and focused on that. Most groups, the NCCN panel, for instance, has endorsed sort of the strategy outlined in the major clinical trials. The dilemma is that you can repeat what was in the trials, but that still won't match the cases now because we know where we want to give the treatment, and that complicates things. But it may be worth more rigorously looking at. And it must be said that there's going to be more data on this. I mean, the studies are going to mature. They're going to be really going sort of case by case through the charts, looking to see whether the exertional dyspnea as reported really was, you know, symptomatic heart failure, similar to the Krek analysis in the metastatic setting. And so we're going to learn more about this. But we're not going to have data for 20 years of follow-up until everybody else at this table is retired except me. So, you know, you're going to have to make... Ageless, but, but you're going to have to make decisions in the real world. And, you know, along those lines, this is a good problem to have. Look, the same issues about are we poisoning people unnecessarily were raised when they started to give chemotherapy at all in the adjuvant setting, when they started to give anthracyclines in the adjuvant setting. And when you prove that these things are worthwhile, you have to overcome those resistances. There still is concern, and we'll come to this later in the program, about the late effects of anthracyclines on non-HER2 overexpressing disease. But in breast cancer, the only treatment which really has damaged people's heart to a degree which is clinically long-term bad is radiation therapy. That clearly causes accelerated atherosclerosis and has historically negated some of the advantage of, for instance, post-mastectomy radiation therapy. We think we're doing it better now, but it took 15 to 20 years for that to emerge. And there's no way that we're going to know before the San Antonio meeting or the ASCO meeting or whatever any of the really important answers to this issue.